Tonight on Banfield, one weekend, still no sign of a dangerous escaped inmate who thought nothing of killing a hostage with a pickaxe and shooting at a deputy. Did the authorities in Texas mess up royally on both the escape and the manhunt? And then a year and a half ago, Portland, Oregon decriminalized hard drugs. So how's that working out for them? Has the city set an example for what the rest of the country should or maybe should not be doing? And then, is this model beautiful? Sports Illustrated says she's gorgeous enough to put on the cover of their famous swimsuit issue. But a famous self-help guru and his millions of fans say she is not. Two models who changed the industry, Emmy and Lana Ogilvie, are live tonight with their reactions. Plus, how much money do you need to be considered rich? Brand new surveys out pinpointing the exact figure. And if you've ever wondered how close you are to being wealthy, tonight we'll tell you, all ahead on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. Nobody likes a killer, especially the vicious kind, the ones who use knives and guns and pickaxes to ravage their victims, cause unparalleled pain, and put innocent lives in danger. But one of them, as we speak, an escaped inmate, is traipsing through the woods between Dallas and Houston, no doubt with plenty of unsuspecting people in his path who are nothing but expendable to him and mere fuel for his journey to freedom. Make no mistake, Gonzalo Lopez has nothing to lose. He escaped custody 1 week ago today. And here's something unsettling. Multiple sources have told me that jail staff discovered reading material in his cell, material that prepped him for a life on the run and in the wilderness. So he may just be a lot more prepared than the deputies first realized. And since he was serving two life terms, the only thing standing between him and one more day on the run, frankly, doesn't stand a chance of living. And that's upsetting, or at least it should be, to the lawmen that are hunting for him. We were told they were working hard. And as manhunts go, that involves a combination of boots on the ground and blanketing the media. That last part, the media. Blanketing the media is both sure to check the boxes, right? It makes sure that everybody in his path is warned and aware of the clear and present danger that this fugitive presents. But it also gets as many eyeballs on this search as possible. Public eyeballs. That's exactly what ended the Casey and Vicky White fugitive odyssey last week in Indiana. A car wash manager recognized Casey White's tattoos because he had seen Casey and Vicky on the news. And there's Brian Enten interviewing them. So imagine our surprise when two nights now in a row, the public information officer for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, whose job it is to inform the public, instead said the first night, too tired. And the second night just outright declined, and I'll quote, until he had something to report. I am no bounty hunter, folks, but I know a manhunt when I see one because I have literally covered hundreds of them. And the innocent people who could be in the path of this capital murderer should be paramount to the officer's work out there, next to capturing that convict. Being available to the media, as I said, it checks both boxes. But instead, 1 week into this manhunt for a lethal fugitive who stabbed the prison bus driver in the chest with a shank and commandeered the bus despite two armed personnel who were guarding it. It's nothing to see here, folks. No need for a public update. And that got me wondering a little deeper into the story about maybe how he escaped in the first place. Because I'm not kidding, this story is getting stranger by the day. First of all, let's just count them up. How on earth did this dangerous convict, number one, get on a prison bus armed with a shank? Number two, get out of his cuffs while in the bus? Number three, cut a hole in the partition that separated him from the armed driver, whom he stabbed in the chest. All while the guard that was in the back of the bus is sitting with a shotgun and is supposed to be watching over the inmates. So there's no funny business. Number four, how did two of those armed guards then ultimately fail to get this inmate under control and instead allow him to get back in the bus, albeit shooting out the tires? So he gets back in the bus and can drive it a mile away until it crashed, but not before giving him a clear shot at a run for the woods. And number five, how did officers allow him to do this? Run several hundred yards across a wide open field and disappear into those woods. All at the same time, a young Texas kid is able to capture video of the fleeing inmate on his cell phone, along with at least one other officer who was clearly not running after the escapee.
Yo, we saw the inmate.
Oh my God.
What the heck?
He's in the woods.
We know. Sure doesn't look like an emergency to me. There is a ruthless killer escaping with a shank into society, and no one is sprinting after him. Or more importantly, it doesn't look like many people are shooting. Because if you ask me, the life of a ruthless murderer who is headed for the hills is worth a whole lot less than the innocent people who may be in his deadly path. And it's not just me. The law agrees. 1 week, hundreds of officers, dogs, horses, heat, seeking, gear, and bupkis. Nothing. No sign of that killer. And no warnings on national television to the public? Did the Texas authorities screw this one up royally? And are they staying mum? Because it is becoming painfully clear that may be exactly what they've done. Joining me now live is Chris Wecker. He is the former assistant director of the FBI Criminal Investigations Unit, and he led the search for Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber, so he knows a thing or two about hunting elusive fugitives in the woods. Also with me, Dan Eckert, a criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor, once upon a time also a federal agent. Welcome to both of you. Chris, I'm going to begin with you if I can. I just don't understand why the authorities aren't blanketing the news and soliciting the help of anyone and everyone who A, can help, media included, and B, can warn people that this horribly dangerous, lethal killer is out there.
Yes, it is curious, Ashley. I mean, you always want to leverage the public as much as you can. The only thing I can think of is that this is a county of 15,000. They think they know they've got him somewhere in the rural, you know, out in the hinterlands there. And they may not need the general public at this point. They have posted a $50,000 reward. But everything I read, and my good friend Steve McCraw is head of Department of Public Safety there, they're very good at what they do, and they're very much involved with the 300 other officers. It sounds like they've got him somewhere in that area. They don't believe he's gotten out of there, at least in the most latest reports.
Well, gosh, you know, I wish I could tell you something, you know, newer than yesterday at 5, because right. That's when they told me about this wanted guy and the fact that they had narrowed the search down to 5 square miles. And we've heard nothing since. And so, Dan, jump in here with this, because I just covered a manhunt last week where two fugitives covered 3 states in just a couple of days. And so how can they be so sure he's in those 5 square miles? Because they ain't seen him yet. And number two, how about getting on the national media in case he's not in that state, in case someone was there to get him and drove him far away?
Yeah, that's a great point, Ashley. And I agree. You do want to leverage the, you know, the public. Obviously, you've got more eyes in the public than you do just the law enforcement that's involved in the investigation. And given, I guess, his alleged contacts with the Mexican mafia, possibly some Mexican cartels, you know, there is that possibility that it's not just a Texas manhunt. It could be something that could encompass other states or possibly going across the border. So it's not a bad idea to get the resources of the media, the public involved, at least get it on their mind all the time in case they see something. Just like the car wash incident where the fugitives were caught in Indiana, Mr. White. I mean, that's a great example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, Vicky and Casey White were caught because the car wash manager saw Casey on the news because they were making themselves very available and putting this story all over the news. But there is not a word, you know, from the authorities who are leading, you know, this manhunt. And not only that, too tired last night to be on this program. And tonight, sorry, we'll call you when we think we need to. And I just have not experienced that in my many years of covering manhunts. And I think that, listen, it's two-pronged, Chris, like I said. Number one, you need as much help to catch this guy as possible, right? But number two, you've got to make sure that every person out there who could potentially, you know, be a barrier to this man's freedom knows that they've got to be very careful with what they see in their shed. They've got to be very careful with who they pick up on the highway. They've got to be very careful with people they spot, because this man used a pickaxe on a hostage when he didn't get the ransom, and he shot at a sheriff's deputy. He cares nothing about human life.
This is a thoroughly dangerous individual. You're absolutely right, Ashley. It's a two-pronged thing. You want to make sure that the public is aware he's out there, that he's dangerous, to not confront him. We've seen in manhunts over and over again, desperate people like him will carjack, they'll do home invasions, lay low there in a house. But everybody in that county is in danger right now, if in fact he's still in that county. And as I said, they seem to think that that's the case. But you're so right. Mexican mafia connections, cartel connections, killed somebody with a pickaxe. It was a drug ransom situation. Shot at deputies, got into a high-speed chase, serving a life sentence. This guy's not going to get taken alive, in my opinion.
Serving two life sentences. Right. Okay, so in the interview, you know, way back early in the week, that the Texas PIO for the, you know, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, in that interview, he was all too eager to highlight the heroics of the prison guard in the back of the bus. And so let me just rerun a piece of that interview. Take a look.
Another officer who was in the back of the bus who quickly and heroically and smartly decided to shoot out the back tires of the bus as it was driving down the highway. He had gotten out of the back of the bus through the emergency door, shot out the tires. Lopez then lost control of the bus.
Dan Eckert, that's a real pat on the back for that guy in the back of the bus, who was a shotgun-wielding prison guard watching over 16 inmates with a partition in between him and the inmates, and then another partition in front of the inmates and the driver. And somehow that shotgun-wielding guard didn't notice one of the inmates wriggling out of his cuffs, bending down to cut open a slat so he could crawl under and stab the driver. I don't call that heroic. I think your job was to shoot out those tires, and you should have nobody going and patting themselves on the back while that killer's still out there somewhere. Call me crazy, Dan, but why on earth would two armed guards not be able to overpower a man like that?
Well, you know, I do think you make some good observations about how this in fact happened when you have armed, correctional officers or guards on the bus. But it is a difficult situation. A lot of times the resources, the training, I can't speak specifically about the Department of Corrections for Texas, but a lot of these municipalities or these agencies will put somebody in a position where they're overwhelmed. And it sounds like Mr. Lopez and some of the other inmates that are on this bus were very, very violent, very serious criminals. And unfortunately, with any job, prison guards, any job, people tend to get complacent. They tend to get lax. And so there's a routine. And so it's day in, day out. Hell, we're taking the inmates to wherever we're taking them, even though there is that opportunity for these inmates to do something, you know, terrible, as it happened in this case. So I would think it's just an issue of complacency. And I agree. I mean, there was an action taken, obviously, a use of force action where they stopped the bus. But could they have done something else? Could they have done a better job? Probably.
No. They didn't stop the bus. There. The bus made it a mile down the road, and because the wheels were, shot out, he crashed.
I meant stop the buses with shooting out the tires. Yeah. No, I get it. I do know the bus was able to
big
progress
important
farther.
Here.
But yeah, those are hard questions, and what they should be doing, or I'm sure they will do, is an after action report or after action investigation.
No, I hope so.
Where they're going to drill down and talk to everybody and investigate what they did, what they didn't do, and what should have been done. particularly if you said there was a shank on the bus. He was able to compromise his restraints and get to the bus driver. Those are all terrible scenarios in a correctional setting.
Like I said, I kind of want answers. And Chris Wecker, I'm going to ask you a question. This is uncomfortable, very uncomfortable for me, because I have always been a proponent of law enforcement. I respect law enforcement. I worked for Live PD. I am thankful every day that they put themselves in harm's way for me. But I also have to ask questions. And one of the questions, I'm not going to lie, that came to mind, is it possible that this might have been an inside job? Because I just covered a guard who turned, a guard named Vicky White, who was amazing. And then she turned and she made things very dangerous for a lot of people. Is it possible that with all these weird circumstances in this particular manhunt, that there might have been an inside job here?
Yeah, I think there's it wouldn't be the first time, and I think there's a great possibility. I mean, at least this was gross negligence, multiple breaches of protocol. But when I look at his connections, Mexican mafia, they run the prisons in Texas, pretty much. I mean, they are in charge. They are the worst of the worst, and there are plenty of numbers, and there's plenty of connections both inside and outside the jails. So it's not a stretch to think that they either compromised or bribed somebody to help out with this. The investigation will reveal that. But this is, as I said, at least gross negligence, if not something intentional happening here. So Ashley, I think you may be hitting on something there. And I especially fire on the Mexican mafia connections, because they do have great influence in prison. They actually intimidate the guards.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm not suggesting that this was something a guard necessarily might have done for monetary gain, but perhaps that guard could have been intimidated by the Mexican mafia to do this, threatened to do this. These are all questions I'd like to ask. But strangely, I can't get them to appear on camera during a manhunt. So naturally, my spidey senses are tingling. Chris Wecker, Dan Eckert, thank you. Chris Wecker, Dan Eckert, that's tricky. Thank you both. Appreciate you both coming on. Yeah, really, no kidding.
Thank you.
Might be on to something there. Okay, for years, it was just say no to drugs. And then almost 2 years ago, the voters in the state of Oregon collectively said no to drug criminalization. So how's that working out for them? We've got a progress report, and you're going to like this. Coming up next. Welcome back. If you watch Fox News, you have probably seen that Portland, Oregon is on fire and has been for the last year. If you watch MSNBC, that is not the case. There is nothing to see there. Don't worry about it. But folks, make no mistake, there is something to see there. And while it is not an inferno, it is a problem. And it's something that the rest of the country can probably learn from. Back in November of 2020, voters in Oregon approved a measure to make their state the very first in the country to decriminalize most street drugs. And I am not talking about weed. I'm talking about the hard stuff. Meth, cocaine, heroin. It is called Measure 110. And the idea behind it was simple. Instead of so much money, taxpayer money, going to the arrests and the prosecutions and the jailing of all these people with small amounts of drugs, the money would instead go to treatment centers. Drug addiction would be treated as a healthcare issue instead of a law enforcement issue. On its face, that actually sounds like a pretty good plan. But a year and a half into this experiment, take a look at some of Portland, Oregon's, our affiliate's coverage of what's been happening in that city.
Overnight, Oregon became the first state in the country to decriminalize most street drugs. A measure 110 also brings new support to addiction treatment and recovery.
Starting today on this February 1st, small amounts of illegal drugs will now be decriminalized in the state of Oregon. And this is because of Measure 110. If someone is caught with small amounts of drugs like heroin and cocaine, they will only get a ticket that comes with a $100 fine. Law enforcement can seize the drugs, but instead of arresting someone, they will now give someone, in this case, that ticket and the number to call, a 24/7 hotline to call for a health assessment.
They tell me that the meth we're seeing on the streets these days is super pure, super potent, readily available, and cheap. And when you put all these factors together for a sustained amount of time, which we've been seeing it for that sustained amount of time, it creates increasing collateral damage to not only those addicted, but the community and their families. And that's exactly what we're noticing right now in the city. We're also noticing overdoses tick up and take over the place that of opiates, which has been a change over the last 5 years. There are other contributing factors, and these are for our people who are homeless, living on the street.
All I've seen is drug deals go down, orgies.
You see people camping and hanging out on the streets.
People using drugs, people having sex, people fighting.
We wound up calling the police.
You're frustrated.
Very.
And she's not alone. Look, nobody is suggesting that homelessness and crime in Portland are all brand new since Measure 110 took effect, but there is a healthy debate over whether that measure added fuel to a crime fire causing unexpected consequences. Joining us now, Sergeant Matt Ferguson. He's the leader of the special investigations in the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and Morgan Godvin, who serves as a commissioner on Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Welcome to both of you. Sergeant, I'm going to begin with you if I can. So what is your assessment of the streets of Portland in the year and a half since Measure 110 took effect?
Well, the team that I supervise works on trying to investigate those multinational and large regional criminal organizations that are trafficking drugs, and we are seeing more drugs in our community than we've ever seen before.
And what about the reports that I'm reading of these encampments and sort of like drug parties that are spilling out of a lot of these safe havens that have been put into neighborhoods where, you know, drug addicts can come and have a safe place to be, but they're spilling out into the neighborhoods who now no longer feel so safe?
Well, I think those are accurate reports in a lot of those places. And what we're seeing is we have a tremendous user base. We have a significant addiction, as you mentioned earlier, public health crisis with addiction. And the idea behind Measure 110, I think, was to have some treatment beds available, and those simply aren't available. So we've sort of encouraged in a way and legitimized drug use, and it's provided this opportunity for those multinational drug trafficking organizations to come in and flood our market with staggering amounts of drugs, and especially fentanyl right now.
So, Morgan, I want you to step into this conversation. You have a very unique perspective because of your very rich history. You serve on the Measure 110 Oversight and Accountability Council. You also personally found recovery, this despite incarceration. So I get the impression you still defend Measure 110, but is that harder and harder to do as so much of this crime starts spilling into these neighborhoods?
Well, Measure 110 only decriminalized very small user amounts of drugs, typically about one day's worth. So drug dealing and all other types of crime are very much still crimes. The fact that most crimes are not resulting in an arrest is a law enforcement issue that the police are facing in the city. Fentanyl is fentanyl is a national problem. About two-thirds of the 108,000 Americans that died in 2021 died from fentanyl use. So this is a national scourge. And Oregon's overdose rate is not elevated. The entire West Coast, we missed the first wave of the fentanyl crisis that devastated the Northeast because we had black tar heroin, which was a little bit harder to adulterate. But now we've seen this influx of fentanyl pills all over the West, not just Oregon. In fact, Alaska has had the highest year-over-year increase in drug overdose deaths. But West Virginia has much higher overdose rates than anywhere on the West. I do not want Oregon to become West Virginia. We must be willing to embrace the public health approach that the West Virginians were unable to do.
So I'll tell you what, Matt, Sergeant Ferguson, this Morgan makes a good point, and I actually have some statistics. Mm-hmm. I have statistics here that show other states are seeing huge spikes in drug use, sales, and overdoses as well. Take a look at this. This is fatal overdoses by state. Morgan mentioned West Virginia's number one. Look way down on the bottom. Oregon is 39th. So out of 50 states, it's doing, you know, measurably better than most of the other states. So is it, you know, how do you sort of accommodate for the fact that this law hasn't made Oregon a more deadly place for users?
Well, I'd say this year we're on par to double our overdoses from last year. And I don't know that anybody that's recently that's had a child that's died of a fentanyl overdose, I don't think telling them we're 39th is any consolation. I don't think that that's an appropriate response to that. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, and we haven't seemed to be able to get a hold of this. And that's going to be our biggest push, I think, within these coming years, is to address those things. And we certainly don't look at users. When we do drug investigations, we look at those large-scale organizations that are selling commercial quantities of drugs. But we have such a large user base that, you know, it's kind of just supply and demand, and the demand is huge. And as long as that demand is there, that supply is going to be here.
So Morgan, jump in here. I have a minute left, and I really want to hear your thoughts on this. In a one-year period after Measure 110, drug offenses, I mean, naturally, as expected, dropped from 880 to 364, clearly because the law said, you know, let's not criminalize people with small supplies. But at the same time, so many people in Portland, Oregon are upset with the crime that has moved into their neighborhoods because of these safe spaces that are being set up for the users. And that can't be a positive, a positive result from this measure. Do you agree with that?
There are no safe consumption spaces in Portland. I support them because the evidence supports them. So just to clarify, drug decriminalization is broadly supported by scientific consensus, including the director of NIDA, the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police. There's broad support for this. And I agree with Sergeant Ferguson. This is an urgent matter. We must address it now before we become first in the nation. We have spent $1 trillion on the war on drugs to end up in the worst overdose crisis in human history. And Sergeant Ferguson is saying we just need to do the drug war a little harder, a little more, tweak it. I'm saying no, we need to do something differently because the goal is to save lives. And if we want to save lives, we know exactly how to do that. But are we willing to do those measures? I am, and we are doing them here in Oregon. We are investing $270 million in the next two months in drug treatment services.
I see that Sergeant Ferguson wants to respond to that. Go ahead, Sergeant Ferguson.
I think our safe communities start with a safe community, and we don't have that right now. We don't have places that are, you know, having safe streets and safe parks and being able to go out in your front yard and enjoy our community is not an option right now that we have here, unfortunately. And a lot of that is focused around the crime that comes with that drug use. What we are seeing is a massive influx in shootings and other types of crime related to drug use. And that is simply unacceptable in our community. It's not a matter of going after users. It's a matter of looking at the larger crime picture.
So I have to leave it there, but I'm so thankful to both of you for...
These are national issues.
I'm thankful to both of you for your perspective on this, and I'd love to continue this conversation because I think everybody wants to know if this experiment could work for them. Sergeant Matt Ferguson, Morgan Godvin, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Still to come, she is on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, so she must be beautiful, right? Not so, says one self-help guru, and his millions of fans agree with him. Is beauty getting too woke? After the break, two former swimsuit models who changed the industry will join me live with their reaction to the controversy, and their answers just might surprise you. Welcome back. The brand new Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue hit newsstands today, but the controversy surrounding it has been raging since Monday. At the center of the storm is cover model Yumi Nu, a Japanese-Dutch recording artist and model. Last year, she was inside the magazine, and she was praised for being curvier than the average SI model. This year, the reaction was equally positive until this tweet. Dr. Jordan Peterson, a clinical psychologist, college professor, and self-help guru, tweeted out the picture of the cover with this comment: "Sorry, not beautiful. And no amount of authoritarian tolerance is going to change that." The tweet has been liked more than 63,000 times, with many of Peterson's followers, millions of followers, defending him and tweeting similar messages of their own. But Peterson's tweet got way more hate than it did love, with some Twitter users accusing him of body shaming, sexism, and racism. Peterson has refused to back down or apologize for the comment despite the backlash, instead saying he's going to leave Twitter, which is odd. For her part, Yumi Nu does not seem that upset about it all, posting this video to her TikTok account.
"I mean, I don't even know why you girls bother at this point. Like, give it up. Yep. It's me. Yep. I win. Yep. You lose." Yep.
Well, she's clearly having fun with it, but this really has sparked a much larger discussion of what is beautiful. After the break, I'll be joined live by two famous models who changed the industry. One of them was when Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue herself. They'll have reaction to Jordan Peterson's comments, and I'll ask them if they think the beauty biz is getting too woke. Welcome back. A controversial tweet by a self-help guru has sparked a huge backlash and launched a massive online debate about what it means to be beautiful. The new Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue hit the newsstands today, and one of the cover models is Yumi Nu, a Japanese-Dutch recording artist and model. Most people praised the choice of a curvier cover girl, but not everybody. Dr. Jordan Peterson, a clinical psychologist and YouTube star, tweeted a picture of the cover with this comment: "Sorry, not beautiful, and no amount of authoritarian tolerance is going to change that." As you can imagine, most of Twitter did not like that, and Peterson was hit with tens of thousands of negative replies. But a lot of his supporters pushed back, defending him and his statement. And he's got nearly 3 million followers. So what does it all mean? Is it time for more diversity in modeling, or is the beauty industry getting too woke? I'm joined by two people who know everything about this topic. You know Emmy as the first successful full-figured model. She was one of People magazine's 50 most beautiful people two times. She's also a body image advocate. And I have, this might be my fourth or fifth time interviewing you, so welcome. It's good to see you again. And Lana Ogilvy is also a very popular model. She became the first model of color to sign a contract with CoverGirl Cosmetics. And she appeared in the 1994 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Her skincare line is called Lana Ogilvy Cosmetics, aptly named. Thank you both for being here. Emmy, I'm going to start with you. So what do you think? What do you think about this whole brouhaha?
It is, it's a conversation that needs to happen. And I think that this person who said that Yumi is not beautiful and no authoritative comments would change it, it sounds like, you know, he sounded pretty authoritative of putting a statement down. And I love that he did this because it's going to get us to talk about this issue that is clearly an important issue to talk about. You can't be one way and not one way of beauty. You have a whole bouquet of beauty. We've shared this together. We've talked about this for years and years and years. But it's shocking that this this individual who is a psychiatrist or a psychologist would say this nationally. I wonder if he's looking to bring himself into the news. It's really horrendous.
Did you experience this kind of thing when you were, you know, getting your career underway? Did people say to you that you shouldn't be a model because you were full figured?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. And I was a reporter before I was a model, and I remember thinking this is just very bizarre. It's such an unusual, you know, the photographers and some of the stylists did not want to shoot me. They were afraid to have images of a woman that was not a size zero or two. But there were clients that really wanted us to work with them because they knew that there were 100 million women above a size 14 that they were developing clothes for up in the early 90s. And, you know, it's only been an incredible opportunity for retailers to be able to have a beautiful array of clothing. They're not stupid. And so it's interesting that this particular individual is going to put, you know, a wash of negativity on something so celebrative. So many women, millions and millions of women around the United States and the world are just applauding Yumi's beautiful image, as well as, you know, we see Musk in her 70s, and we see other women in SI swimsuit looking gorgeous, whether they're size 0, 2, or 4, 6, or 8, or 10, or 12. They're a whole array of women. And not only, you know, we have a bouquet, a hues of color of skin. So this is what beauty is all about, not just one standard, one
I was
absolutely
surprised
impossible
to see
standard to fit in.
Impossible. You're right about that. So I was surprised to see Elon Musk's mom, and she did look spectacular, like just gorgeous. I can only hope to look like that, like,
right,
tomorrow. So, Lana, jump in here, because, man, 1994 swimsuit issue. You had a lot of firsts, you know, and I wonder how much you experienced as you were sort of breaking into maybe what others didn't think was the ideal swimsuit issue model.
Well, I mean, you know, certainly, I guess, you know, during our time, you know, me and Emmy, the response from idiots like this guy wasn't so immediate, you know what I mean? And I'm sure there were people that didn't think I should have a CoverGirl contract or didn't think I was beautiful or didn't think I should be in Sports Illustrated or any of this stuff. But the response from people's negative attitudes wasn't so immediate. You know, sure, this guy is out there and he has a public Twitter account. He puts out his own opinions. That's what Twitter is for. Obviously, you can't put out things that are, you know, going to cause violence or whatever. But if he doesn't think she's beautiful, hey, that's his opinion. But the whole, what, you know, what Emmy just said about the authoritarian part of it that he's put down, well, he's doing the exact same thing. And Sports Illustrated didn't, in fact, do that, because there are four different covers. So if you don't like the way she looks, you don't, and I don't know why, because the woman's drop-dead gorgeous, but if a full-figured woman doesn't appeal to you, hey, man, that's okay. Look at one of the other covers, you know, or don't look at it at all, either way. But, you know, to come out, and you know why he's looking at it, right? Don't make any bones about it, why most men look at that, right? And I was in it myself. But if she is not appealing to you, Kim Kardashian's on another cover, Ciara's on another cover, Mae Musk was on another cover. So, you know, what is your deal here? And you're supposed to be a self-help guru. Like, I'm sorry,
yeah,
what you've just done
was...
seems to be the exact opposite of that. Like,
right,
did you forget
exactly
about that when you were tweeting this? Or, you know what I mean? And
well,
it's always amazing.
But then there's this whole idea,
the cover,
right? There's this whole idea of that the pinup model, and a lot of perhaps men, and I would say women too, because women consume this kind of media as well, are thinking, wait a minute, that's not the fantasy, that's not the, like Emmy said, the impossible, the dream, the thing, the unicorn that we all want to achieve.
But I actually think, the thing is, Sports Illustrated is a magazine. It's a Western magazine. They are appealing to their audience. Now, beauty has different ideas. Beauty is just someone's opinion, you know? It's not a fact.
That's right.
It's not like 1 + 1, which makes 2. And in every part of the world, what people or the general public in that particular area or country might consider beautiful is completely different to the next society. So Western society has this one kind of idea of what beauty should be. Sports Illustrated is catering to their market, which is mostly the United States, right? They've offered 4 different covers, which they feel are going to best sell their magazine. And
business,
that's really all they're doing.
Yeah.
They're not laying down any totalitarian voice at all. I mean, they're just trying to sell magazines.
We're going to go through the 4. We're going to go through the 4 covers so that everybody can see the different ones. There's the one that you were talking about with Kim Kardashian, And then there's Mae Musk. That's Elon Musk's mom. And that is definitely a different demographic than we had expected before. So, guys, I do want to ask you a little bit about the changing, and I'll call them ideas, not ideals, but the changing ideas about bodies. Because prior to Twiggy, who ruined my life and made, you know, the idea that we should, you know, look at it, skinny as a rail, right? Like, Twiggy came in the 60s and she was skinny as a rail. And for 30 years, we all had to be skinny as a rail. Before that was, you know, Marilyn Monroe. And she was not. She was 5'5" and I think 135. So, you know, this was the idea of spectacular and beautiful before Twiggy came along and made it, you need to look like a boy. And then Kate Moss came along and made us, you know, reminded us all we needed to look like a boy. And then came Kim Kardashian. And then came Jennifer Lopez. And, you know, and Lizzo. And so where are we headed? Any quick last comment. Where are we headed?
It's the bouquet.
Well, I hope it just continues to become more diverse. Women. It's a bouquet, like Emmy says.
Yeah, sorry. Emmy, I got 20 seconds left.
Yeah, this is who we are. Beauty comes in all different shapes, all different sizes, and all different hues and ages. And this is what SI swimsuit is reflecting. It's no longer just this ideal. And those that protest so much are probably checking out all of it and enjoying it. And I think there's something going on with this gentleman that really didn't have something nice to say. Good to see you, Lena.
Emmy,
yeah, Lana, good to see you too.
Thank you both. I just what a delightful conversation.
Thank you.
I'm
happy that Sports Illustrated is embracing all of this. It's wonderful.
All right, I'm going to turn from beauty to money. Those are things we all look to, right? When I say the word rich, how much money do you think you need to be in that league? $100,000, $1 million, $10 million, more? New survey has pinpointed the amount of money Americans think they need to have in the bank to be considered rich. Find out what the real number is and how close you are to it after the break. Welcome back. Before the break, I asked you, how much money do you think you need to be considered rich? The answer, according to a new survey, is $2.2 million. Charles Schwab surveyed 1,000 Americans ages 21 to 75, and that was the average of all of their answers. And by the way, that is up from $1.9 million in the survey they did just last year. $2 million might sound like an impossible number, but the team behind the survey says that every household is different and that you should settle on a number that is realistic for you. But it's always nice to dream. Pooh. 2.2 milbos. All right, that's it for us. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. Special report with Marnie Hughes and Leland Vittert gets underway right after this break. We'll see you here tomorrow night.